Welcome back to the Bright Lights of Broadway. This is The Cosmic Curtain, the official podcast of Cosmic Circus Broadway. I'm Brian Kitson, head writer over at The Cosmic Circus and Cosmic Circus Broadway. And joining me, as always, is my co-host and fellow backseat babe, RJ Miller Zelenko. How are you doing today, dude?
A little toasty, but we'll make it through. gotta be glad for the sunshine in Michigan.
Absolutely. It's not going to be here for much longer. We're headed towards
the
fall and the winter.
Take it while we can.
I also never call you dude, so I don't know where the hell that came from. But on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the first official show for this 2024-2025 season of Broadway in Detroit, Moulin Rouge the Musical, which felt like a tongue twister there for a second. This show is adapted from the 2001 Baz Luhrmann film of the same name, starring Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor. Have you seen this film before?
Plenty of times.
Is it a staple in the Miller Zelenko household?
Actually, no, because of what it is.
That's fair. That was a stupid question.
For sure, probably. I think I discovered it when I was in high school. Like, probably got it from, probably heard the soundtrack on, like, this ages me, but I used to go to the library and take out CDs, and that is how I got my music collection, because I didn't have an iTouch back then, iPod, and so I burn all the CDs out of my computer, maybe upload them to my MP3 player and or CD player, and before that, tape player, but that's a whole thing. So Moulin Rouge, the soundtrack, was one of the ones that I got, which then prompted me to, of course, find the DVD and or VHS at the time. And honestly, that probably didn't happen until close to college.
Wow. Okay. So quite a bit of time since it came out, because you were going to college like 2011, 2012-ish.
Yeah, it had been out for a minute. It wasn't new. It for sure was not new when I saw it.
First off, you did carbon date yourself by saying getting CDs from the library.
I mean,
but also I did the same thing. My first one was Britney Spears' Toxic, and we just never went back. But it tracks 100%. I did not see this movie either until 2022. I did not see it until Marty and I were going to New York. And we were seeing it live, and she's like, "Are you so excited to see it compared to the movie?" And I said, "I have no idea what the movie even is. You can tell me what the plot is. I wouldn't be able to guess that." And so she made me watch it. And so it was just 2 years ago, and I think I watched it like four times since then, because it was just like, I was like, wow, this is such a good film. It's a great story.
Yeah, shame on you for not seeing it sooner. Just kidding. But
as you waited a decade,
I mean, it is very much like the next, as we know, like we have these decades of the Romeo Juliet type stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Shakespearean
love.
Yeah.
Tragedy.
Yeah. So
would you consider this a romance or a tragedy when you're thinking about Shakespearean law here? Probably a tragedy.
I mean, tragedy, which, of course, like, always, I feel like, comes with some type of, like, a lot of love stories, you either resolve it, in which case it is, like, it ends well. It's a ideal love story. And, or, this is literally just a flip, and it doesn't, and it is a tragedy. But I would still consider it a love story. I mean, it's the plot line being so predominantly around love.
I mean, that is fair. I think that, you know, isn't the comedies end in marriages and the tragedies end in death. And I think, like, with that rule, it does obviously fall into a tragedy, but 100% at the core of this film, it is a love story through and through. And it's like a true love story. It's quintessential.
Well, yeah, as this is about as extreme as you can get in regards to that helpless angsty romance.
Sure. Fair warning, listeners, this should have been a spoiler warning before this point, but if you haven't seen Moulin Rouge, the movie or the musical, you should probably turn around now, because we are going to be talking about things like the ending and what happens with that. So this is your last moment. I'm going to give you a moment real quick. And we're done. So with it being very true to the film, with the only difference being really additional music, do you feel like it was a good adaptation for the stage? Like, do you feel like it was adapted well for the stage, or do you feel like it left something on the cutting room floor that we didn't get in the movie?
I thought it translated pretty well. There wasn't anything in particular that I felt like I was missing, except maybe towards the ending. Just act two overall, it felt like we lost a little bit of the plot, where it became kind of fuzzy and unclear as to even, you know, what room we were kind of in, or where we, what the timeline was, I guess you could say.
Yeah, no, there was, I didn't know if that was because we were moving quicker in the second act or not, but like when they started, like there was a lot of drops in between set pieces. And I was trying to be like, which room are we in? Are we interchanging room now? Are we in? Are we somewhere else? Like, it was kind of confusing at times to find those pieces in that second act, because it was like scene after scene after scene moving very quickly through the rest of the story.
Yeah, there were a few scenes where I was like, are these happening simultaneously and you're panning to the next location? Mm-hmm. Or is this happening over an extended period of time? Is this happening over a, you know, 24-hour period? Which in live theater, that's so hard to determine because, typically the first act, it is a little bit more elongated. You have a better idea of the timeline because they're setting that stage, literally. Mm-hmm. Whereas act two, you're like, and here is everything you've been waiting for in 60 minutes.
Yeah, you're right. When you're missing the half an hour, I see what your argument is. We just need a 3-hour play, 3-hour musical.
Yeah, you know, just tack on a couple more minutes, a couple more scenes, make it super clear.
There was a scene specifically that I feel I actually did get a little bit confused, and I don't remember being confused when I saw it on Broadway. But I also know that the set was different, and we'll talk about the set a little bit later. But the scene where he is singing Roxanne, which was like almost like a fever dream from drinking the absinthe, and then she was wearing Satine and the Duke were wearing the same costumes as they went into a scene that was actually happening in real life. And I remember thinking, like, I was like, is this still a dream? And then, like, it wasn't, because, like, they were in the setting of the chalet, the chateau, or whatever they call it in the musical. And it was, like, a real scene between the two of them. And I was like, I get that you couldn't, like, change costumes really quick, but I think that that was kind of lost in translation for that aspect of the show.
Yeah. Yeah. And because this show is so kind of, like, dream sequency. There are so many of those moments, even where they kind of try to fast forward through those sequences, and that's where it's hard to follow, because you're like, all right, we're slowing down, we're speeding up, you know, am I pumping the brakes, am I pumping the gas? Not really sure.
And I think that kind of leads into the next question as well, is that between those scenes, those sequences, the fast-paced scenes, the slow-paced scenes, is that there was two distinct tones to this story. There is the fast-paced world of Moulin Rouge, which has that like high-powered romance between Christian and Satine, and then there's the tragedy and the slower parts and like the difficult topics of like being abused by a man, and those kind of are that darker concepts, you know, dealing with death and with grief and being controlled by somebody. And while it seems like they did a really good job to balance those two, do you feel like there was sometimes that got muddled?
Maybe a little bit. Also, there was, as we experienced some sound, being opening night, there was some sound, maybe some mic difficulties happening. And so some of those kind of key, maybe more tragic scenes were actually literally hard to decipher. And as someone who, yeah, I've seen the movie, but I've never seen the stage version, so much storytelling happens in those moments. And so if you're not able to comprehend them, you lose probably some pretty vital pieces.
Sure.
And so I think, a couple of those scenes out on the street, it was just a little bit like, what exactly is going on? You had a general idea, but yeah, would have liked to capture that a little bit more, but it happens.
There was definitely, especially during the dialogue parts, I'm thinking of the opening scene with Christian and Santiago and Toulouse, where they're kind of talking, like the hills are alive scene, and then they started talking, and like it was all very like South Park, like wah 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 wah, or Snoopy the adults, and you're just like, I know what's supposed to happen here, but I don't know what's happening here.
Right. Like I get the general idea, but the specifics are lost.
Is that, does that, I know we're gonna talk about this a little bit later, but I'm just gonna jump into it. Does that throw you out of the show a little bit when that happens? Because there was quite a few, and I know we talked about this with different levels of show. There's like community theater, we expect maybe a little more issues with like mics and like technology and stage presence. And then there's like the professional touring shows. And there was, this is maybe one of the ones that we've had quite the most like feedback or mic issues. The opening of the second act, the first song had like the big, like one mic was feeding into another, and it just like drowned out everything because it was like that droning for like, I don't, like 15 seconds. It wasn't long, but does that throw you out of the
Yeah,
story?
it's pretty rare for that to occur during this caliber show, right? And so people, when it happens, it kind of throws us off because it does. It's you can't ignore it. Like as much as you can try to ignore it and still very much enjoy what's happening on stage, our senses are on overload because there's a blasting noise in our ears. So I think it does. Of course, it's a distraction. Like any distraction. I would say it's equal to when someone's cell phone in the audience goes off, right? It's things that you can't necessarily control all the time. Even though, it doesn't matter how many announcements you make about that, there's always going to be at least one. And in our case, I think at least five. So, it's unfortunate. And yes, they're professionals, but mistakes happen and/or the unexpected happens, especially with technology. And so, flying by with a little bit of grace, can't completely ignore it, but also that's the name of the game.
And I do think, something you had said a long time ago when we kind of started this journey was, seeing them on like the opening day or two is going to be different than going to see it on that last week because they're still getting used to like the stage and like the sound and how to kind of operate. And like get and so that obviously you could see that in this one where, we don't usually have a lot of shows at the Detroit Opera House, and this one was one of the first ones we've had in a while, and you could feel that like it didn't quite fill the room in those moments because of technical difficulties out of their hands. And it has nothing to do with the story, has nothing to do with the acting, which was great, but there was just those technical difficulties. There was like, wait a second, what's going on here,
And I mean, I think the older the buildings too, like the Opera House is a historic building and it has that type of architecture that is extremely difficult, I'm sure, as a sound engineer to figure out in without having done it literally ever before. Because as you know, with some as someone who's had experience kind of seeing these tours come in and set up and I mean, they have, less than 24 hours to basically build a set, get the sound up, get the wiring throughout the entire theater, not just close to the stage, and then test it without actually any performance occurring prior to that. I mean, you test one microphone at a time, but that isn't going to give you the same effect as a full orchestra and a full stage of people on top of a full auditorium. So
And it has to be tough when you're going from city to city. Like, when you go to New York, they're in those theaters 24/7. They're so used to it by now. even on those first couple of days, they probably still maybe had some issues, but it's all worked out and it's the same house the entire time. And that equipment is going from house to house. That's that, you know, and that's kind of crazy. It's kind of like a carnival, but for theater.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just think it's really the equivalency of if you go to, you know, an amusement park and they test those rides every morning, right, to make sure that they're still in working order and that everything still goes right. And even by doing that, something can still go wrong. And so I know even on two show days, they are testing mics, they're testing sound, they're testing lights, they're testing everything that moves prior to the show. But that doesn't guarantee that it's going to work.
Is that slightly off topic, but I just got to know, with being in a community show such as Sweeney Todd, do you still do all the soundtracks every single time and you move the pieces and you test it all out?
So completely, not even a little. Well, okay. I shouldn't say not even a little. No would be the short answer.
Okay.
It does depend on the theater. Every theater has its own way of doing things, but I will say in my most recent experiences, really, we're just turning things on. maybe if there's some trick props or for instance, we use a blank, a gun in Sweeney Todd. And so that is something we practice prior to the show, obviously, to make sure it works, to make sure the person is comfortable using it, and that it's show ready. Same thing for there's obviously utilization of a trap door that also gets maneuvered to make sure, you know, everything's in working order. We don't have anyone go down it, but we just test, like, hey, this mechanism is working.
It's unfortunate that you don't get to go down the trapdoor. I just want to say that. Like, it sounds like it'd be a fun time.
I couldn't be happier. I could not be happier, truly.
But going back to the tone of Moulin Rouge, I do think it's really interesting how the duality of it really speaks to the bohemian theme that is running through Moulin Rouge of just, like, love, justice, you know, there's darkness with light and there's lightness with dark. And I think that the show does capture that really well. And it's very interesting because when I was speaking to Robert Petkoff, I brought this up, and it's not many shows that you see that can balance, like, this duality of, like, light and dark. And I think Sweeney Todd is another one of those too, where it kind of dances on that fine line of, like, we're talking about death, but we're also, like poking fun at it, or we're also, like, we're poking fun at life, and, like, we're dealing with these dark topics, but we don't have to have such a horrible time about it. And, like, at the end of Moulin Rouge, you kind of get this where, like, after Satine dies, the show kind of ends on this dark scene, and then, you know, Harold Ziedler runs out and is kind of like, no, we're not doing that, and, like, ends on this big number that began the show. And so I feel like those tones were kind of really coolly played throughout Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, I mean, once again, we think about tragedies and we think about what the audience really wants, right? Like, not too many people feel great leaving after a true tragedy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you don't particularly walk out of Romeo and Juliet and say, like, woo, so good. Feels so good.
It's the West Side Story effect, you know? They put the credits at the end for the first time ever with that film because they knew people needed time to collect themselves, and you just can't walk out of that and being like, wow, life is great. Like, it sucks. What about the story kind of stuck out to you? Was there anything specific that you were just like, this is fantastic? Wow, that was exciting. Or, you know, was there just anything that just caught you by complete surprise?
I don't think by surprise, but of course, because I was familiar, right, with the storyline. I think that kind of, like, true love at first sight ideal isn't something in its time when the show originally was created, I'm not sure that it was super prominent in such a modern way.
Sure.
We'd seen it in the very classical, once again, referencing Romeo and Juliet, referencing West Side Story. But in this case, it's giving people coming from two unexpected worlds. Like, neither of them is mainstream, I would say.
Sure.
And so that is a differentiator for this particular storyline or plot.
Is he not mainstream because he comes from Lima, Ohio? Just kidding to anybody living in Lima, Ohio. I'm sure it's great there. But you're right. She's a dancer at the famous Moulin Rouge. And that back in the day was the equivalent of like kind of going to a strip club, you know? And so she was living on this darkness. And he was an artist, and was still to this day. Those two professions get a lot of flack from a lot of people. Like, you don't go to school to be an artist because you're gonna be a barista, you know? And why would you go to, you know, be a dancer? Like, what are you gonna do with that? And so that it was a very interesting kind of play with those characters. And it is, you know, the title of my review, which is still being written, is that Moulin Rouge, the musical, did make me believe in the concept of love again, you know? Not that like I didn't believe in love, but it's just so like purely, like, they see each other, they fall in love, and it's just they cannot be parted from each other. And there's a part of that is very charming, I guess is a good word. You know, it's just very like it pulls you in, and you just want them to succeed so bad in their love that it makes you believe in that concept again of love at first sight.
Well, and I think it has a little bit of that push-pull that maybe that's a little bit toxic, because we do, like you mentioned, like we do kind of, it makes us believe in love again, but it's also kind of this like not good looking love, right? Like,
right.
It's basically encouraging a side piece, right? True. Even though we know that it's love, we're calling it love, we're calling it romance. Mm-hmm. And villainizing the Duke, which rightfully so, he is the villain, but mm-hmm. Applying that to everyday life could be very, very dangerous, right?
100%.
But also could be, unfortunately, applicable to many people. So I can see it from all different directions, especially in modern day, because life just looks different now, especially when it comes to love.
Right. And, you know, I do think that when you look at the Duke, at his core, he's emotionally manipulative, using his money for those things. So like, we can look at that and be like, wow, you are the bad guy. But you're right, when you look at it from like a, if I was in his shoes, not if I was not doing the emotional manipulation, like, would people be rooting for the other person? Like, in a show like this, yes, you are rooting for them, but that's that gray area again of just like, in real life, it makes you believe in true love, but there is a dangerousness to this. And this one, it is, the Duke is the dangerous one, but there's also a dangerousness of the grass is always greener, or like we call it the fairy tale syndrome in psychology, of like everybody sees the best life on Instagram and Facebook, and we think, wow, that person must be living the best life, and why does my life suck? And we get into a lot of those problems because we can't let go of that finding there has to be true love, Cinderella story, getting swept off my feet, and that's not always what love is. So I think that's a very valid point about this story.
Well, and I'll just say also, one of my first perceptions when the Duke first came out was that he was not what I was expecting. I'm not okay. Sure why. Maybe in the movie, I feel like, and I could be totally wrong, it has been a minute, but I feel like he was portrayed by an older man.
He was.
And so that also substantially changes the dynamic, because at first, when you meet the Duke, at least in my humble opinion, I didn't hate him. Like, I was expecting to kind of hate him and feel gross about him right off the bat, which is the way that I felt with the movie. Comparatively, you have this younger and or kind of same aged man coming on, mm-hmm. You know, he has a lot of money, but like, once again, living in today, even, we know this kind of stigma around like chasing people who have money, right? Like that is very much a real thing. And so you don't hate him for that. Obviously we learn to hate him based off of the emotional manipulation and like abuse that's happening. But really, I feel like that didn't really take place primarily until Act Two, which
yes.
I'm sure is probably intentional, but it was way more of a conflict internally for me in regard to the Duke and Christian more than I ever thought it would be. Because of the way that that was set up. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but that was one of the biggest things that I noticed immediately.
No, I think it's a valid thought because I just looked it up. The actor who played the Duke in the film was 9 years older than Christian, Ewan McGregor. He was only about 5 years older than Nicole Kidman, but most female actresses, they play much younger. So she's probably trying to be about the same age as Christian. So think about it, 20 years ago, they're probably in their 30s. And he was clearly, he's 10 years older than her, and that's a big difference. You know, you're thinking of somebody who's, that difference you can look at and be like, that doesn't feel like that's right. But our actor who played the Duke wasn't any older than the other two people. Like, he was very much, and they did play that up where he was much more smooth and he was suave and he was, you never even really got a sense of who he was in that first act, honestly. He was just the person that they were almost bamboozling, and like, in a way, you almost kind of feel bad for him. You're just like, oh, wait a second, like, they're just trying to take you for your money. And it was like, I want to say like mid act two when he really just kind of flipped that switch and was like, oh no, I'm the bad guy. I'm clearly supposed to be the bad guy.
Yeah, I think the only thing I can think of would have been when he purchases everything.
Yes.
But even then, you're like, okay, well, this club is going under. This makes sense, right?
Yes.
Like, he is still doing good by what we want, right?
Sure.
But, yeah, just a little side sidebar there, but...
But also, in that instance, if it was such a bad, you know, not that it wasn't a bad thing, but like if it was such a bad thing, you think in your head, would the Harold, would he have agreed to it? And granted, what is the word I'm looking for? He was desperate. There was a desperation to him to want to keep that club open. But you'd also think of like, you didn't have to take it if you're getting completely screwed over. And like, so I think like there's where that kind of gray line is. He does kind of tell Harold, like, I'm going to control everything. I'm going to own you. I'm going to own her. It's all going to be mine. But Harold also agrees. And like, so you're just like, okay, so it's okay then. It's like, you're getting everything you want. Everybody's getting everything they want. We're getting, you know, Christian's getting his music presented to the world. And, you know, Satine is getting what she wanted. You know, she wants a life where she doesn't have to dance the rest of her life. And Harold is getting to keep the club open, and he's going to kind of still be the face of it. Like, everybody's winning in that moment. Is he so bad for being like, if I'm financing all of this, I have majority stake in it? Because, like, that's how business works, too.
Well, right. And I'm even thinking to some other shows where I think even maybe it was beginning of Act 2 when he takes her out to get dressed, right?
He says...
I'm thinking of every other show that we've seen recently that kind of has this very similar idea. I don't know, maybe it was Funny Girl and or Pretty Woman.
Both of them.
Both. That have those scenes, literally a scene focused on this transformation piece based on the person that they're with, right?
Yes.
So the idea is, it's an age-old idea. And it's usually rooted in the fact that that is indeed what the woman has been saying that she wants, or is at least acting like she thinks that's what she wants. Mm-hmm. So yeah, once again, we don't, even though we know it's kind of gross, we don't hate it. It's more so foreshadowing than it is like an act that we despise.
I was even thinking in my head too, you mentioned those two shows and I was like, yep, yep, absolutely. But even when we went to New York, Water for Elephants has that a little bit too, where she's wants to be with the elephants, she wants to be with the animals, but she's kind of playing this role to keep the ringleader, the circus owner, happy and dressing up and doing these things, but she wants to be more of the wearing the jeans and getting in the dirt and learning how to care for these animals. But there wasn't really a scene in that, but there was those dynamics of just like you have to play a role and you're playing the role and you're changing for this person because that's what's expected of you.
Right. I mean, at the end of the day, they're looking out for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Like their psychological safety, which is bouncing off of their need for somewhere to live, something to mm-hmm. eat, you know, all of those things, which is why it all makes sense and why we don't hate them for it, right? Like, we don't sure. hate the women for wanting what's best for themselves and wanting a better life, which is why we then eventually strongly despise the actual perceived villains.
Would you argue, I'm gonna argue this, I guess, and I want to know what your thought is. In the end, then, with that thought process, is Harold Ziedler actually the villain? Because he was the one that told Satine, play your role, be the diamond, sleep with this man, do whatever you have to do to get the money. And she, feeling trapped, did that.
I think, I was just thinking about that. I think we don't know enough of their backstory.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're trusting that their backstory is so steep that this is just a commitment that they've made to each other.
Sure.
And that it's a mutual... I think that's maybe what's shown a little bit more in the movie than it is in the production, mm-hmm. is we see more of the caring side of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels less transactional. Whereas yes. in the production, it's very much like demand, demand, yell, demand.
Mm-hmm.
Not really... Like, just being pretty direct about it. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, here's what you need to do. You know what you need to do. Do I need to spell it out for you?
Right.
And then there's only like one scene where he seems kind of concerned for her, maybe mm-hmm. a scene and a half.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, but
it was kind of,
I
it was kind of at the end of the act.
Does he fall under villain? I mean, I think maybe a little bit. Maybe that's a, you know, unpopular opinion, but
I think it definitely,
there's still an abusive relationship there, emotionally abusive. There's an age dynamic. He's running a club. He knows what he's doing. He knows what he needs to say to make her do what he wants. And that's the manipulation piece.
I was going to say, because I don't remember the film that well. I mean, I remembered enough. I know the general gist, but I remember thinking that he was more of like a father figure and less of like a business owner. Like, he was a business owner and he did care about that. But there was always this like, I have a soft spot for you. You're kind of like my daughter. I took you under my wing. We're doing this together. And it does feel like he was more relegated to like the connective tissue of like from start to finish, this is how we book on the show. Kind of like that character in Pretty Woman, who was like the magical fairy godfather that like didn't really have a role, but he did have a role. And this one was a little more of a role, but it felt like they took a step back to focus more on Christian and Satine instead of making him a more well-rounded character. And so I think that's where the like, maybe people will look at him and be like, wow, you're kind of a villain here. You're kind of at fault for some of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's be real. There's fault can be shared, right?
Sure.
Everyone, 100%. Everyone makes decisions at the end of the day. There was pressure on multiple sides. And the story just alludes to the fact that Satine had no other options.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at the end of the day, like, some of those decisions were still hers, right?
Absolutely.
So everything, you know, that's where we balance it, right? That's where we justify do the ends justify the means?
Right. And in fact, the moment where she finally took her own power was when she decided to perform when she was dying. And like, it was at the end, it was like this like last ditch moment of like, I love Christian. And that was when she finally decided, there's many times, again, the time period and the storyline, she didn't have a lot of power, but there's plenty of times where, you know, us as the audience can look and be like, wow, did you have power in this situation? And when she finally did, her decision was, I'm going to do what I want, and it doesn't really matter anyways because I'm dying, you know? So, which adds a layer to this. I also want to just make note, too. I think I told you this last night, but when I first saw the movie and the play, I thought her name was Saltine. I thought she was a saltine cracker, and it was after Act 1 in New York, and I was like, that is not her name. So
that is not her name.
That is not her name. So, Satine, I am so sorry. This is a jukebox musical, which we know that's not one of your favorites. That's not one of your favorite styles. And we had a whole breakdown when we went to New York about like what constitutes a jukebox musical. And I think that this applies to that because it is nothing but popular music from popular songs. So for you, does this effect work for Moulin Rouge?
Yes.
There's a but there. I can feel
Well, because really I'm thinking between two versions, right? So for those who don't know, like the version of Moulin Rouge that we saw is, I don't know if we can call it reimagined, if we can say current, if we can say the new and improved, but it's not the movie. It is not, the music is not what you, aside from like a handful of staple pieces, they have updated the production to represent the modern age. And integrated those songs into the show. And so it's a little bit distracting. And even last night, there were almost every single time a new song began, there was laughter.
Yes.
In the auditorium. Because I think the expectation, once again, like me, I forgot. And I had been looking forward to this, right? Like I genuinely forgot that this would be what it would be. And so I think people came in, some of them imagining exactly the movie, right? Many people knew that. And so to then come in and hear Katy Perry,
yes,
you know, to hear Adele.
Walk the Moon, like.
Yeah, there was a comedic, and it almost was, because you're not used to. It's so cheesy, which Moulin Rouge is. Like, the original is very over the top and like out of this world type. But because it was implanted into today's time, it felt a little like almost too on the nose. Especially the crazy.
When he's
on the, it's supposed to be this intense emotional moment where his heart's just been broken, and because they just basically took a pop song that typically is a little bit more, it's got a beat, they basically took it and made it a ballad that it did still have a beat, but they turned it into a ballad, and I think it was like almost too far where people just couldn't take it seriously. Because in their minds they're just thinking of the original tune. And same thing with Firework by Katy Perry. That opening line, you know, you're supposed to take her so seriously, but all you can think of, literally the second she starts singing, even though it wasn't the same lyric, all I thought of was, do you ever feel like a plastic bag? And that's not the first thing. She sang another verse, but that is all. I was like, we're talking about plastic bags in the middle of this ballad emotional moment. So I think that's where the laughter was coming from. And so circling all the way back, jukebox, not my favorite, but I do think it lent itself to this production. I think there's enough of a plot, there's enough of a storyline, and just enough scenes happening that it didn't feel just completely disoriented.
There is, I thought automatically when we were in this show, I thought of our time seeing Anne Juliet, where people just laughed like very frequently. And you're like, the one was, when the one character was singing about, not a girl, but not yet a woman. And granted, there was probably some laughing for other things there, which we won't get into, but there was just this, like, this very serious moment, and people were giggling because they're like, ha, I recognize this song. And Kylie, who went with us when we were driving home, she was like, I don't understand why people started like laughing during Crazy. Like that's supposed to be a deep song, and it is a deep song, but it just feels so like almost out of place of this, like, you know, we're telling a story from like, I think it's the 1800s, and it doesn't feel like it, like some of this music, it does fit, but it doesn't.
Yeah. And when it, literally when I think of that song, and it could depend on age, right? Because these are, a lot of this music is stuff that we have literally grown up with. Our, you know, millennials have grown up with. Like, I think of that on a karaoke soundtrack. Like, that is the first thing when I heard him start singing that. I said, oh, you know what? On my now 20-whatever CD, that's number 7, you know?
Yes.
And so, and, like, those are the songs that you wail along to with your friends. And you're not singing it well. You're singing it poorly because it's just kind of stupid and fun.
Yes.
And so I think that those, it is, it's really where your mind is at, and or if it's what you're expecting. Because if you're not expecting, I think some of that laughter comes as nerves.
Yes.
Because
I agree
you're
with
not,
that.
Have I ever truly listened to the lyrics of that song? Because it did go very well for what was, what the point
yes.
of it was. But have I ever slowed it down to be like, oh, that's what that, that is the context of that song. I have
yes.
not.
And there was a few moments of this, like during one of the opening songs, Truth, Beauty, and Freedom, Truth, Beauty, Freedom, Love, when they start singing Royals, and people really giggled at that because, again, it's just like, it feels so out of place. And you're just like, and it fit the story and it was perfect. Like when he's like almost speaking it, you're like, oh yeah, like, that's the bohemian thoughts of like royalty doesn't exist anymore because we're all royal, you know, and, you know, we don't have to be royal. And like, so that like worked really well. People still like were, it was like that you said, that uncomfortable giggle almost of just like, what do I do with this? Songs like Elephant Love Medley, that the closing of Act One, that nobody really questioned because it was just all these love songs and there were so many of them put together. That you were catching bits and pieces, like at the very end when it was the little touch of I Will Always Love You. And I was like, oh, that, like, that gave me chills. That was really cool. That worked really well. But people didn't question that one as much.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of those being, I think one of the most prominent ones that did stay the same was that medley. There were still some new songs in it, but they had at least 2 to 3, maybe 4 songs that were original. And so I think it kind of, made it comfortable enough for people because they, you know, they were expecting your song. They were expecting, Come What May. They're, you know, so there are certain ones that they're like, oh, and this rings a bell. This is what I'm here for. Whereas, yeah, the, you know, Royals, it was, it, especially I think, cause I think that's one of the first ones. It was just like the initial shock of, oh, I see
yes.
what we're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, so there is a song in between that, a Welcome to the Moulin Rouge and the one with Royals, but it's the one where there's just riffing on The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music. It's not really like, it's like a beat and you blink and you miss it moment. And then we're going into Royals.
And that one's in the movie, right? Or at least partially. Like that premise is when they're up in the attic or, you know, in the loft. So,
And I think people, I noticed too that this one did have a lot of audience interaction, which we're not always used to when we go see a Broadway play. Again, I think it's with this music idea, but like starting the show off with like something like Lady Marmalade, like that everybody knows. There was a lot of clapping. There was a lot of whooping. I noticed that there was this. Do you like that audience interaction to that extreme? Because it very much felt like we're kind of part of the show, but like. Maybe not really.
Yeah, I think it's hard to monitor those things because you have audiences who are going to be very familiar with that type of interaction. And then you're going to have folks who would not dare. I mean, they're barely clapping, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have people who are hooting and hollering and standing. And then you have the people who literally are not moving. And so the crossover, like those two extremes make each other uncomfortable. So then you're trying to find the pulse of the room, and on stage, like, they have to set it, right? So I think they did a pretty good job at setting it. Usually if they do want interaction, they're kind of reaching out to the audience, right? They're clapping, they're kind of leaning, or their actions are mimicking what they want you to do. But very much, once again, this, I did not expect this to kind of be a copy and paste of Anne Juliet, and it did kind of feel that way. I know it's technically the other way around, but
sure.
Even down to the fact that there was a pre-show.
Yes.
And that also prompts audience participation, right? Because you're not asking the audience to really pay attention, but you are at the same time. You're giving them the opportunity to pay attention, but you're not asking them to pay attention.
Right. And they definitely warmed it up. And there's, I just have to set the scene for you listeners. There was sword swallowers on stage. Like, they were trying to get your attention, but it was in a very passive way. These dancers were coming and walking out and walking on the stage and off the stage, and they were doing slight different things, but it was all very slow, building up towards the opening moments. And it definitely, it was interesting, because that was definitely, like, the Anne Juliet, where everybody was slowly coming out. Some of them had their coffee cups and, like, were talking to some of the audience members, and there was, it felt like, we want you to be a part of it, which did welcome people to be like, I'm gonna hoot and holler a little bit, and I'm gonna have a little bit of fun. Except maybe the people behind us who didn't like that. It was a different adaptation.
Everyone has their opinions.
Was there any song specifically that stood out to you of just like, that was fantastic?
I mean, it was all so good. Because the amount of mashups and medleys and the sheer length of them were insane.
Yes.
Probably some of the longest song and pieces that I've seen in recent years. And so always super impressive. And a lot of them, once again, they are power ballads. They are not, these aren't like gentle songs. So they're singing their and dancing till they basically collapse.
Yep.
And it was just all incredibly impressive. But I mean, the OGs, Your Song and Come What May are my, and probably will always be my favorites, just because the songs themselves so well written, and I mean, it's just like, Come What May is just such an epic love song that you can't go wrong.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm trying to pull this up. But that song, it was specifically written for the show and was not a part, like, a jukebox musical cover here. Which is, totally lines up with you liking that song.
Yep. That tracks.
Yeah, it was originally intended for the film William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, however, it was first heard publicly during Moulin Rouge in 2001. You picked the one song as your favorite. One of the songs that you picked as your favorite was one that was written for the show. So, like, it just lines up. It's perfect.
Yep.
I do have to give credit to Rolling in the Deep. I thought that was beautiful. Going from Crazy to Rolling in the Deep, and that very powerful, like, it really kind of led into so much of the ending. I think that might have been my favorite, but I also love Shut Up and Raise Your Glass, just because I think that that mashup is just, like, really fun. You can't go wrong with Walk the Moon and Pink mashed up together. So I do love that one. And you mentioned how active the show was. I don't remember it being that active, but man, they were going from start to finish. How they were not a puddle at the end is insane.
Yeah, I can only imagine their two show days, honestly. I assume they utilize a lot of alternates. or switch tracks or something, because yeah, it is incredible when those dance numbers are, I mean, I think that opening number is like, I mean, maybe even with the two or three lines in between, but I would still consider it the opening scene, like, it's gotta be 15 to 20 minutes long, with minimal stopping by the time they do the pre-show and everything else. It's just a absurd.
It is. So the song itself is seven, almost 8 minutes long. So when you factor in everything else, like, and the way that they kind of break it up, they're going. That's crazy. Congratulations to them. With this being such a large cast and ensemble, was there anybody who stood out to you? I'm going to have to go out here and just say Satine. As we know, as we walked out of the show last night, we know I did love Satine, a favorite. And Santiago as well. That was really thoroughly impressive, Santiago.
I mean, like, you always have to love the leads, right?
Sure.
So I always try to think of a little bit outside of that box, just because, like, obviously, they're so good. There's a reason they are where they are, right? They're just 100%. so freaking good. I mean, I could echo Satine. Christian, vocals were just, I mean, everything was so solid. His tone was so clear vocally. Satine, first of all, by no shock, she dropped it gorgeous and can dance like none other. But the vocals were interesting to me because her tone was darker than I expected. It was a little bit deeper than I remember. And maybe, and I'm thinking it's because in the movie, her pitch is so high.
Yes.
Like her voice and everything is so, like, waspy. And that was not this. That was... Mm-hmm. At least for me. I mean, she was still feminine and light, but there was this, no other way to put this, but like Adele-like quality to the tone of her voice. Mm-hmm. As we all know, Adele has those super kind of deeper tone, power ballad songs, and it's a little bit more swallowed, and that is the tone that she was giving for Satine, which was a little bit shocking just because character-wise, I'm not sure that super felt aligned.
Sure.
I wasn't upset about it, but it just felt substantially different than what I was expecting.
Because when you think about, like, with Nicole Kidman being the original one, she has a very, her voice almost, like, floats, you know, like an airiness to it. And then you take... You know, you think about the time frame too of just being like, what was going to get people to come into the seats, and you probably didn't see a lot of people being appreciating that deeper voice in the 1800s. You know, they wanted the Marilyn Monroe aspect almost. You know, of just being like super high, super the registers way up here. But yeah, she was very rich, very low. And something that Kylie pointed out too is that she had a vibrato that was just like out of this world.
Yeah, it was very well monitored. It wasn't too much, which once again makes sense for their character. Like, you're not expecting Satine to just have a vibrato, because once again, she's kind of lighter and airier. And I think it breaks the character a little bit because you're supposed to see her almost as this, like, fragile thing. And so if you have this kind of sturdy... deeper, stronger. I mean, vibrato is hard, right? If you have too much of it, it can come across as like too powerhouse-ish. But yeah, she had a good balance, I think, even of portraying when she wasn't feeling well versus when she was feeling okay-ish throughout the show.
I actually felt like when she started to not feel better towards the end, when she had finally made up her decision what she was doing, her voice got stronger. And I thought that was a very interesting take, because it's like you would think of somebody's getting weaker. They're like, they're sick. They're like, they're almost not talking. But hers was like, she had that determination of like, this is what I'm doing and this is my choice and this is my life. So I liked that aspect of it because I felt like it added like a solidness to the character of like, for the once in my life, I get to make my own decision. That I thought that was a really cool, like, with her voice that really went well to it. Turning to the lights, I think that we need to talk about the lights real quick, because we have seen a lot of plays through Broadway in Detroit. We have not seen a lot of shows that use lights the way that Moulin Rouge did. What did you think of that? Because there was a lot of spotlights, a lot of smoke. There was the stars, I think, is a big thing too, and the different neon signs. Like, what were your kind of feel of all this?
I mean, 100% match what I would have expected. It's a club, right? So you're expecting to be dazzled. You're expecting the bright lights, the neon, the over the top, because not only are you giving just the regular stage lighting, but you have to have it really amplified by like 10 to make it as dramatic as what's happening on stage. So yeah, the visually, the big lights, it's not like they were trying to hide exactly what was happening and what they were doing.
Sure.
Because it's a show within a show, right? So yeah. I thought it was very well done, very appropriate, and substantial in regard to the darker kind of, we talk about those tragic moments. We talk about the lighter moments. A lot of cool effects, I think, to the absinthe scene and, yes. Even to the glowing cups, the glowing props. You didn't have to do that, but it's just one of those things that pushes it to be just that much more. And a lot of that lighting, too. You mentioned the stars. But I did think about the lighting. Maybe it was during his, when he's loading the gun, I think, and he walks across the stage and you just kind of watch each light up after him or in front of him, which was unique. But yeah, so many lights and special effects used in this show.
I was kind of blown away with, because again, you think of a show as simplified and, the sets themselves were simplified. They didn't have the actual elephant, which I vaguely remember there being like a turntable elephant for some of those scenes when it was on Broadway, which I didn't expect that. You expect a more boiled down show, but I was like amazed at like the way that the spotlights worked, like, and that like they, or like the scene where she dies and it's like this, like, godly light coming down and it looks like she's floating in to like the afterlife. And the stars were really cool too, when they like open up the whole scene and they turn around and they just kind of, they like wave and all the stars light up. It was just really cool. It wasn't something I was expecting from a tour show, but I was really glad they were able to capture that essence for the stage. Cause I feel like that adds to that beauty and charm of the bohemian lifestyle that they're kind of talking about throughout the show.
100%.
I do have to. Will you? We have to talk about your sister real quick. Your sister went with us, and I think her favorite part of the show. And it probably wasn't her favorite part of the show, but she loved the confetti cannons from the cane.
1000%. 1000%. I don't know. I have no idea. but also, like, is but that is just like, I think, the pure joy of theater, right? The pure joy of live theater. It's unique, right? So we're used to, especially like she, I'll give some context here. She was on stage at the age of 6 months old, literally on stage at 6 months old. So she has been in and around theater her entire life. So she's been around lights. She's been around sound. She's been around costumes and sets. So really the things that kind of maybe sparkle a little bit more are those very, very small details that maybe, you might not think about at all. And it wasn't, I don't even think it was the confetti itself, but rather the way in which the confetti, as we know, the way in which the confetti came out. And once again, though, that immersive, experience, right? It made you a part of the show, which not every show does that, and just to such a high level and to such a degree. But it did make me laugh, when I asked her what was, your favorite part of the show, and the first thing out of her mouth was that she was amazed by these cane cannons.
My mom, bless her soul, she finally learned how to watch the stories and she saw them. She asked me, she was just like, so the canon, like the King canons, and I was like, yeah, Becca loved them, and even made a comment at the end of Act One during intermission, and at the end of Act Two, I actually like leaned over to her, and I was just like, all five of those are gonna shoot. And then they walked off stage with the cannons, and I said, oh no, it's not gonna happen. I just lied. I just like broke this poor girl's heart because they're not popping off. And then they came back with them, and I was like, yes, okay, good. This is still happening because she was so excited. And that was really cool to experience that, because you're right. When you go see so many shows, you can almost become like disillusioned with some of it. And like to see like there's still something that could take someone who's been acting since 6 months old by surprise is really cool. And it is really cool.
Yeah.
So for overall vibes, because we are wrapping this up, unfortunately, we're at an hour, but we're going to talk real quick about overall vibes. You had mentioned when we were outside the show that you did not cry. Do you feel like the show did not have the same emotional punch that the movie did for you?
Man, I mean, Act Two, once again, very, very quick. Very, very
Yes.
quick. And I'm not sure. Like, maybe I just need to see it again. There was just so much happening that I feel like I was trying to pay attention to that I kind of lost the love story a little bit. And
Sure.
so then, and the last scene is so quick. I think I was expecting a little bit more of a pause and a little bit more of a silence than we got, even just from the timing on stage. Like it seemed very like shift one, shift two, shift three, rather than
Yes.
like, okay, shift one, silence, shift two. And sorry, what I mean by shifts is usually something's changing on stage.
Sure.
And so,
Go ahead and use that actor lingo around us. We don't, no, most of us don't know what the hell that means.
So her, her death, I felt like I missed a little bit of the dramatic end, right?
Sure.
But also, like, you don't want to draw that out so much because all the show's already 2 hours and 45 minutes long. So I
Sure.
get it. I get it.
Sure. But sometimes you need that beat of a moment. I'm thinking like, granted, six was only is only 90 minutes, but like at the end of all you want to do is like where she like gasps and they like you stop there and you're all just like, whoa, what did we just do here? Like, what did we just witness? That moment was missing because it was all of a sudden like she fell to the ground. She was, Christian was holding Satine. She dies. They pick her up. They carry her out, and it's just like over.
Yeah, I think maybe what gets lost, the way that that scene plays out in the movie versus the way, because you also lose the Duke somewhere
Yes.
in the production. Whereas in the movie, there's this kind of dramatic scene that's overlapping, you're overlapping her death, right? And so there was almost, it felt like no conflict, like she just kind of died.
Yes.
And he didn't seem shocked. Maybe that's what got me is like he doesn't know that she's sick, right? Like it's a so for her to just literally die 5 seconds after they seemingly make up because she sings him the song, like that felt weird to me,
Anticlimactic.
staging wise or script. Really, it's a script thing, I would say. I wouldn't even say it's production. It's probably whatever's written in the script, but yeah, so maybe I preferred the movie in that side. But also
Which is fair.
you get more emotion, right, in movies too. You're up close, you see their tears, you see their pain.
Right.
In stage shows it's a little harder to see that. So
And I do wonder, and I brought this up at the end of Act One, and I'm just going to say it real quick because maybe it's the Mandela effect, maybe I'm not remembering correctly, but the fact that I checked with someone who went with me and did not prompt them to give the answer, I feel like maybe I am justified in this. And if there's somebody else who has seen the show very early on it in Broadway, please let us know in the comments. Send us a message. But I remember Act One ending with, after the love songs, it goes to her standing there on the stage in a single spotlight. The rest of the stage is black. She coughs up blood and she like almost does the gasp from like six, and then it cuts to black. And I was expecting that. And I actually turned to you at the end of Act One and I said, that's not how that's supposed to end. And I was so justified in that for like all night until I got home to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia was like, "Nah, dude, you're wrong." And then I reached out to my friend, and I was like, "How did the Act One end?" And she was like, "It ended with her coughing up blood." And I think that that would have changed the dynamics. And if that did not happen, maybe that's what should happen, because what it does then is that the audience knows how sick she is, and you get more of the drama of why she made those decisions, because we really didn't see her cough up blood to almost like halfway through Act Two, it felt like. Like, we were knee deep in Act Two, and all of a sudden she's coughing up blood, and you're like, oh, she has tuberculosis.
Yeah, I mean, they allude in her opening number, right, to mm-hmm. her just gasping, but it's the opening number, or, well, not the opening number, but her opening number, and you have no idea, like, you're not looking for her to be sick, right? So you almost sure. would not catch that in any way, shape, or form. But you know,
so does this production have rewatchability for you? Like, is this a show you would see again if you had the chance?
Yeah, I would. I think, I mean, it is extremely entertaining, like point blank for entertainment value alone. Go see it. It's a spectacle, and it's supposed sure. to be. And, I think it brings something to the table for all, well, I'll say mature ages, or at least parental advisory in regards to age. Because, of course, like, this is a dancing nightclub. There mm-hmm. there are risque scenes and costumes. Sure. But in regards to the entertainment value for, you know, multi-age, I think even though it might have not been the music that some folks were anticipating and or the show that people were anticipating, I think everyone walked out having a good time, mm-hmm. Which just tells me, you know, that there's always more to see and more to catch every time that you mm-hmm. see it.
I agree. I think that, you know, when I saw it originally in New York, this was my sleeper hit of the shows. I was blown away by it. And I still felt the same way. And I felt that, like, this is one that I would go see again. I would take my mom to see, maybe. But, like, this is a show that does give you something new each and every time you see it. So, absolutely, listeners, catch it when it's on the road. Catch it in Detroit for the next 3 weeks. It actually overlaps with our next show, Some Like It Hot, which I did not realize until I started planning interviews out and stuff, that this does not end until the 6th, and Some Like It Hot starts on the 2nd. So of October, which is not usually how it happens in Detroit. So that's exciting. So get your tickets, go see it now, enjoy it. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Cosmic Curtain, the official podcast of Cosmic Circus Broadway. My name is Brian Kitson, and you can find me on all the social medias at Kitson301. RJ, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram, tagged at journey_through_the_pass_.
And don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe to us at Boxy Babes or at My Cosmic Circus. If you are interested in finding us outside of our box seats, please check out our socials, which we already gave you. So clearly I did this out of turn, but that's okay. Till our next curtain call, everybody have a great night.